part of what we're going to do tonight kind of flows from that, because it's going to be about rebellious hearts, rebellious people. You know, the scripture says that human heart is always set on evil. Right? And you always go back to our example, you know, do you ever have to teach a little kid how to be selfish? Do you ever have to teach a little kid how to lie? Do you ever have to teach a little kid how to misbehave? No, because it's our nature. We carry Adam's nature around. And we have... too soft. And we have, you know, as it says in the book of Hebrews, which actually is my favorite book, we have a high priest who sympathizes with our weaknesses. Because Jesus, Yeshua, being the God-man, had our human nature, not the Adam nature, but the human, real human being, real human nature, like us in all things but sin, Paul says. You know, he had the appearance of sinful flesh, but didn't have sin, of course. And he lived with people for 33 years. So he saw all kinds of rebellion. Imagine growing up and he saw somebody over here cheating somebody, and he saw somebody over here stealing money from somebody, and somebody over here, you know, running around with some woman, and he saw somebody over here doing, you know, he was exposed to the whole human condition, right, and lived through it. So we're going to talk tonight a little bit about that, and then I think we'll do this for the next 20, 25 minutes or so, and then I think we should take a little bit of time to pray for the people that are in the path of the hurricane. And we'll have maybe some, whoever wants to lead us in some prayer. But we're going to talk about the Song of Moses. Now, I know all of you have been studying the Bible for decades. So, you know, there's actually two songs of Moses. There's one in Exodus 15, and there's this one that we're going to talk about from the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 31. It's actually two songs of Moses. Interestingly, in Revelation 15, when we go to heaven and we get a harp given to us by God, it says, we're going to sing the Song of Moses and the Song of the Lamb. And then the book kind of goes on to tell us what the Song of the Lamb is. I'm not really sure there's 100% agreement on which Song of Moses we're going to sing, because they're both pretty awesome. I don't know if we're going to sing about drowning Egyptians or if we're going to sing about this one. I don't know if we're going to sing about drowning Egyptians in heaven. That doesn't seem nice. But anyway, and maybe next spring when we do Passover, we can do that Song of Moses. But this is a little different Song of Moses. And if you remember Deuteronomy, second law, the people are right across the Jordan. They're right across from Jericho. They're assembled there. They're ready to come into the land. And just before this passage we're going to read, God reminds Moses that he's not going into the land because he disobeyed. And instead of speaking to the rock, not only did he strike the rock, but he struck it twice. Now, we did quite a few teachings on that, so go to the website and refresh your memory on it. I don't want to belabor that again, but God reminds him he's not going into the land. He's going to see the land, but he's not going to go in. I don't think that was very nice. After everything Moses did, at this point he's 120 years old. And as he points out, you know, in the chapter, I think before this, their shoes didn't wear out, their clothes didn't wear out. And then the next chapter, it's going to point out that even though he was 120, his vision was undiminished, his strength was undiminished, he was still a pretty spry old fella. He was bouncing up and down the mountains and across the desert just like the young guys. And as we know, only Joshua and Caleb went into the land of the people who left Egypt when they were over 20 years old. Everybody under the age of 20 died in the wilderness, except Joshua and Caleb. And that even applied to Moses. And he's called the servant of God. You know, he says, Moses is my friend. I talk to Moses like you talk to a friend. He told Moses, I loved Abraham, but I never told Abraham my name. You, I told my name to. He talked to him like you talk to a friend. And Moses' face would glow, and it was pretty cool. So now Moses is coming down to the end after 120 years. Remember, Moses' life is 40, 40, and 40. 40 years in Egypt, 40 years in Midian, 40 years taking the people to the land. 40, 40, 40. So he's come a long way since they put him in the little basket and Pharaoh's daughter picked him up. It was a long time ago, 120 years ago. So in Deuteronomy 31:16, and if you have a Bible, please read along. And the Lord said to Moses, behold, you will rest with your fathers. Okay? In other words, your end of your life, you're going to rest with your fathers. And this people will rise and play the harlot with the gods of the foreigners of the land, where they are going to be among, where they go to be among them. They will forsake me and break my covenant, which I have made with them. You're going to die. These people are going to be harlots. You know, we hear a lot of stuff about, in the book of Revelation, about the whore of Babylon and all this stuff. The only nation that's ever called a harlot by God is Israel, up until the book of Revelation. She's always called a harlot. She's always called a prostitute. When Hosea has to marry a prostitute, God says, well, see, now you know how I feel. This is how Israel is to me. I'm supposed to be, she's supposed to be my bride. We're supposed to have this intimate relationship with each other. We're supposed to have this intimate marriage covenant, but she's always playing the harlot with other gods. She's always forsaking the covenant. Then my anger shall be aroused against them in that day, and I will forsake them, and I will hide my face from them, and they shall be devoured, and many evils and troubles shall befall them, so that they will say in that day, have not these evils come upon us because our God is not among us? And I will surely hide my face in that day because of all the evil which they have done, in that they have turned to other gods. Remember, idolatry was always condemned, was always to be guarded against, was always to be avoided. Don't carve the stones. Don't use any chisels. Don't bow down to anything. Over and over and over again. When you go to the land, stay away from these people. Don't have relationships with them. So here we are. Moses is soon going to die, and we know that Joshua is going to take them into the land. Now, Joshua is Moses' sort of administrative assistant. At this time, Joshua's no spring chicken either, because, you know, he's been wandering 40 years, and we know he was over 20 when he left the land, so he might have been in his 60s or his 70s. And he's going to take the people in, going to divide up the land, going to, you know, get everything set up. So he's going to live a while too. So the people are going to go into the land, and God says, I want you and Joshua to come into my presence so I can commission you, so I can commission Joshua. So Moses obeys. Moses is not upset about having a successor. Moses is not upset that somebody else is going to be the leader, because he's a servant. Remember, in the book of Hebrews, Moses is the servant of the house. We're all servants of the house, right? Except now, in Romans 8, we know we're adopted children. But Moses is a servant in the house. Joshua's a servant in the house. Moses is not worried about, oh, is Joshua going to be more popular than I am? Is Joshua going to be more famous than I am? Who's this Joshua guy anyway? What's he know? I've been around for 120 years. He's probably only 65. He just got on Social Security. I've been on it for 55 years. Yeah, the Czechs in Egypt, you know, they kept following Moses along. So he's not upset about this. And it says the Lord appeared in a cloud to them, in front of them. This is the only time in the whole book of Deuteronomy where the Shekinah cloud comes back. Remember in Exodus, the cloud was everywhere. The Shekinah was everywhere. In Leviticus, in Numbers, especially Numbers, always see the cloud. It's the physical, visible presence of God. Cloud by day, pillar of fire by night. Physical. And of course, this was the presence of God in Trinity, so that when Messiah Jesus, when Messiah Yeshua says, well, you know, before Abraham was, I am, and they make fun of him and say, you knew Abraham? He says, yeah, I've been around. I wasn't just born 33 years ago, like some of you guys think. I was in the glory cloud too. But it's the only time in the book of Deuteronomy that God appears as the Shekinah. When they get into the land, they're going to see the cloud off and on. You know, when they dedicate the temple in 2 Chronicles 5 through 7, I forgot what chapters in Kings it is, but Kings and Chronicles, of course, are parallel books. So when Solomon dedicates the temple, the Shekinah cloud comes so thick that nobody can see anything. The priests can't minister. The musicians can't play their instruments. Nobody feels like singing because they're totally overwhelmed with the Shekinah cloud, and they have to get out of the building. That's how thick the presence was. There's a great Hebrew word, kavod, that means the heaviness of the presence. And so once in a while they saw it. And we were talking this morning about the book of Ezekiel. Ezekiel is in Babylon. You know, he's one of the exile prophets. He's in Babylon by the river Shebar, and he has a vision. The Lord shows him things that are going on in the temple, abominable things. Idols, statues of idols in the basement of the temple with the priests offering them sacrifices and worshiping them. And God says, they're doing this in the basement because they think I can't see them there. You know, it's kind of like Adam and Eve. Let's put the fig leaves on and he won't know what happened. You know, human solution. So the priests are worshiping the idols. So God says, the temple, everything's going to be destroyed there. And then he sees the Shekinah cloud leave the temple, go out through the eastern gate, go to the Mount of Olives, and go up into heaven. Is that cool or what? You know, when Messiah comes into the city, he comes from the Mount of Olives on his donkey, so Zechariah 9:9 would be fulfilled, goes into the city through the eastern gate. On the day that everybody was picking out their lambs for the sacrifice, the true lamb comes into the city. Then when the glory cloud leaves the temple, you know, this is 586 years before he was born, the presence of God leaves, goes out the eastern gate, across the Kidron Valley, to the top of the Mount of Olives, and then goes into heaven. And the glory cloud is never seen again. So it's kind of neat. But then Jesus comes back. And he's the glory cloud. So Moses and Joshua are in the presence, physical presence of God. So they're having communion. Okay? They're not having bread and wine, but they're having communion. They're having an intimate prayer meeting right in front of the very presence of God who told them to come. And, you know, God tells Moses basically in that passage, the covenant's going to be broken. My people are going to forsake me. It's going to be their fault. It's not going to be my fault. Like when Steve was talking about covenants, was that here or grace? I can't remember. When Steve was talking about covenants, you know, he's talking about, you know, one side breaks the covenant. The other member, part of the covenant, the signatory, you know, keeps his end of the covenant and keeps the whole covenant himself. So God tells Moses, the people are going to go against me, and it's going to be their fault. It's not going to be my fault. You know, what more could I have? He doesn't say this in the passage, but the implication is, what more could I have done for these people? I brought them out of Egypt. I made them my personal inheritance. Nobody in the world is my inheritance except them. I opened the Red Sea for them. They went through the wilderness. I fed them every day, gave them water when they needed to, got rid of all their enemies, and they're still going to turn away. They're still going to turn away. Now, it's not going to be my fault this happens, because they're a bunch of harlots. They don't understand our relationship. And in case you think, you know, oh, we're way past that, you know, we don't have idol worship. Come on. When's the last time anybody was worshiping Jupiter or had a statue of Zeus in their car? Sure, we don't have that, but we got plenty of idols that stand in the way. An idol's anything that takes you away from the true God, right? And that could be our job, our money, our car, our house, our retirement plan, our personal comfort, as we're going to see. And God talks about this in the next passage. Your personal comfort takes you away from God. I heard a great thing on the radio the other morning. I can't remember who the teacher was, but he was talking about how in America, you know, up to this point, compared to everybody else in the world, I don't care who you name, everybody's been comfortable. Everybody's been prosperous. I mean, our poor people would be upper middle class in 90% of other areas of the world, right? I mean, our poor people have cars, cell phones, cable TVs, you know, clothes. Nobody's starving. But comfort and materialism. Still remember the cool picture that Pastor Monica made about the guy buying down to the dollar sign. That was pretty cool. Or how many people on Sunday morning say, I don't feel like going to church today. I'm kind of sick. I don't like the chairs over there. It's raining. And our brothers and sisters in the Middle East are being killed for their faith. Little children are being crucified, beheaded, because they won't renounce Christ. We renounce him in a second. All it has to do is be raining out. That would be good enough. Like Peter. Oh, Lord, you know, these guys. Remember Jesus says at the Last Supper, he says, you know, this night, you guys are all going to be shaken and you're all going to run away, because Zechariah predicted that too. I'm going to strike the shepherd and the sheep will disperse. And Peter says, not me, maybe these guys. But I'll go there and die with you. I'll go there and fight with you. And then a servant girl says, aren't you one of those guys? Not a soldier, not the high priest, not the Roman governor, a servant girl. Peter's scared of. Oh, I don't know. I don't know that guy. Are you kidding me? How would I know him? Even your accent gives you away. No, I don't know this guy. Forsakes the covenant, so to speak. So, he says that their people are going to be harlots. You know, I can't remember where it is. I can't remember now if it's even in Isaiah or Jeremiah. God talks about, they'll commit adultery, they'll be harlots under every tree. They'll have relationships all over the place right in front of me, and they won't care. Now, he's not talking about sexual immorality necessarily. He's just talking about turning away from God, turning away from the covenant, turning away from him as the king. You're going to be my special people, my special possession. Oh, but we want to be just like everybody else. We want to be just... And in case you think that's not happening now, look how many churches are saying, oh, we want to be just like everybody else. Come on in. You know, the world's pretty cool. If we're like the world, everybody will like us better. Who cares about divorce? Who cares about abortion? Who cares about same-sex marriage? Who cares about gender, whatever it is? I'm so old-fashioned, I think there's two genders. I don't know. I think that's pretty scriptural. Yeah. We were at a hotel last week in Cincinnati, and there was a wedding going on. And, you know, silly me, I go back to the room and tell Joan, oh, there's a wedding downstairs. I didn't see the bride and groom, though. Then there was a sign, you know, congratulating Bob and Joe for getting married. And, you know, there's all these people coming to the wedding all dressed up. This is what we've come to. I don't know if Bob and Joe got married in a church. I pray not, but who knows. But anyway, so they're going to be harlots. And idolatry breaks the covenant, just like adultery. These are tricky words. Idolatry breaks the covenant, just like adultery breaks the marriage covenant. Right? I mean, if you have a marriage covenant with your spouse and, you know, every other weekend you're spending with some other person somewhere, you know, what have you done to the marriage covenant? You've forsaken it. And this is how God feels. You know, the church is the bride of Christ. If you study the Song of Songs, it'll reduce you to tears at the relationship that God wants to have with us. In Isaiah, it says, I who am your creator have become your husband. It's an intimate relationship. He doesn't like it being forsaken. I'd like to go to church today, but at 10, if it was at 12, I'd be able to go, but 10? I can't go at 10. Or, you know, today, I don't have time to read the Bible. I don't have time to even say a quick prayer because I've been working all day. I'm really tired now. And plus, I like this show now that's on TV. So you forsake the covenant. Paul says we should pray without ceasing. I don't pray without ceasing. Don't think I'm saying I'm doing that, because I don't. So I forsake the covenant too. Everybody does. But here he goes. So we have idols we already talked about. So God points out they're going to need a reminder, and they're going to need a witness. And this goes, one of my favorite quotes from Martin Luther, who said, we have to hear the gospel over and over again because we're so mule-headed that we forget it. We forget what's going on. We forget what the good news is. Oh, yeah. You know, I signed the card. I said the prayer. Yeah, that's 52 years ago, but man, I got my ticket. I'm ready to go. We need to hear the gospel over and over again, just like we need to be filled with the Spirit over and over again because we leak, as we like to say in the charismatic renewal. So there's always a restatement of the relationship. This is the whole book of Deuteronomy is a restatement. There's nothing in the book of Deuteronomy that wasn't in the other four books of Moses. The other four books of Moses. It's a restatement of everything. Because the people have to hear it again. Plus, 40 years has gone by. A whole nother generation has come to age. I mean, people didn't live to be 80 in those days. Well, Moses was 120, but kind of a special case. So it's always restated. When I have brought them to the land flowing with milk and honey, of which I swore to their fathers, and they have eaten and filled themselves and grown fat, Then they will turn to other gods and serve them, and they will provoke me and break my covenant. Turn to other gods because they're fat, because they're comfortable. They have whatever they need. And this guy, you know, and we've said that here, and this guy I heard on the radio the other day was also pointing out, it was Tony Evans. If you guys know who Tony Evans is, he's one of my favorites. He said, you know, people in this country are so comfortable and have everything at their fingertips that people don't even realize that they need a savior because they don't know what they need to be saved from. Everything's fine. You probably have friends like that, right? What do I need a savior for? I got everything I need. So they're going to break the covenant. So what causes the indifference and the rebellion? Money, food, comfort, sensuality, all these things that are in everybody's day-to-day life. Now, these things in themselves are not bad, right? Money's morally neutral. You know, if you have a couple of million dollars stashed away somewhere, that doesn't make you evil. But it depends what your relationship is with that money and what you do with it. If you say, well, I got 2 million, now I'm going to try to make 2 million more because I think I really need 4 million stashed away. And that's what I'm going to dedicate my life to from now on, is maybe I can even get to 5 million. Then you're not using the money the right way, right? And we can go on. Obviously, there's nothing wrong with food. Every day, the people got manna. And, you know, they rebelled. They got tired of manna. We're sick of this manna. I'd be the first one whining. Right? If any of you have been hanging around in my office, you know, like, oh, I'm sick of, I don't know what I should have. I'm sick of burgers. I'm sick of sandwiches. I don't know what to eat. Donuts I never get sick of, but all your stuff. So it's going to be the effect of their prosperity because their appetites are going to be satisfied. In the wilderness, it wasn't that nice. You know, if you'd have been in, you know, the Massachusetts Bay Colony in 1620, you know, it was a hard struggle. You didn't just go to your house, put your air conditioning on, put the TV on, and relax. And you didn't just, you know, order out for some Chinese while you sat home and ate. You had to struggle to survive. The people in the wilderness were struggling. But then they grow secure. And when you're real secure, it takes away the fear of God that you have. It takes away the reverence that you should have. You can see it even in churches now. The prosperity preachers have 30,000 people in their churches. Why? Because they're saying what their itching ears want to hear. It fits into your security and your comfort. And when the pastor tells you, hey, you'll get even more money than this because you're going to have this awesome life now because you're going to turn your power loose and God's going to reward that. Well, nowhere in the Bible does it say that. Nowhere in the Bible does it say you have any power at all except your power of evil. Right? It doesn't say we have power of ourselves to do anything. So it inclines the people to follow the gods that they're going to find in the land. Look at Europe. I mean, without getting into situations, without talking about denominations, look at Spain. I mean, Spain was so Catholic that they had the Inquisitions, they had all these orders of things, they went out to Christianize the world, they brought Catholicism / Christianity to the New World. They took it all around. They converted whoever they could convert, sometimes violently. But now they have unlimited abortion, same-sex marriage. The percentage of people going to church on Sundays is down to about 30. Look at Ireland. Ireland. I mean, there's a book about how Irish monks saved the world because they went and witnessed to people in Europe in various times in history when things were getting more and more secular. It's not just St. Patrick. They were people that had faith. The mass attendance now in Ireland is down to about 19%. Because now they have prosperity. And now they're comfortable. I don't know what's happening in Poland because, as Joan and Ron know, I love the Polish people because they always kept their culture. They always kept their faith. It didn't matter who conquered them. And in the 20th century, Poland was reformed, then the Nazis came, then the communists came, and they held on to their faith. Now, I don't know. It's declining. It's not like it was 30 years ago. There were more people going to church when the communists were in power than there are now. I don't know the percentages. We were in Europe a couple of years ago, and we went to this beautiful cathedral in Luxembourg. I mean, the place was beautiful. There were like 14 people in the place. I mean, it probably sat like 5,000 people. There were like 14 people in the place, you know, kind of knocking around inside. And there was a thing in the back of the church that said 86% of the people that live in Luxembourg consider themselves atheists. 86%! Not 2%, not 4%. 86%! No wonder there's 14 people in the church. So you incline yourself to the heathens. We now incline ourselves to the heathens of our time. Well, we can't do anything about it. Now, what can we do? It's just the times. I'm afraid to say anything. It's the same thing. Then it shall be, when many evils and troubles have come upon them, that this song will testify against them as a witness. For it will not be forgotten in the mouths of their descendants. For I know the inclination of their behavior today, even before I have brought them to the land which I swore to give them. He knows what our nature is. He knows what's going to happen. He even tells Moses, after a while, they're going to want a king. He has Moses, as we're going to see in a minute, put the law in a little book and have it next to the ark all the time. Because that's supposed to remind everybody that this is the law. And he says, when there's a king, because they're going to want a king. When there is a king, the king's supposed to look at the book and say, oh yeah, I have to be faithful to this. He knows what's going to happen, of course, long before it does. And he says, they're going to provoke me, and they're going to break the covenant, and then my protection is going to come off. He destroyed his own house twice, right? 586 BC, 70 AD. When Jeremiah came, they said, Jeremiah, nothing here is going to be destroyed. We got the temple, we're the priests, we got all the stuff. What are you talking about? A couple of years later, Jeremiah was walking around the city, which was totally in ruins. There was hardly anybody there. And if you read the book of Lamentations, which is very short, you'll see his reaction to this beautiful city where there were people and it was vibrant and there was all these things going on. And now it's just a pile of ruins. So the protection comes off. He's going to hide his face from them. And eventually they're going to say, haven't all these things happened to us because God's not among us anymore? In this country, we've moved God to the horizon and now past the horizon. You know, God, we liked having you around some years ago. And, you know, we liked saying a prayer once in a while. And we liked it when the president said, you know, we're praying for God's protection, and we're going to have this National Day of Prayer and petition God to help us with these. You know, we kind of like that thing, but we don't do that anymore because, you know, that's kind of old superstitious stuff, isn't it? Because now we've evolved. We don't want to hear that anymore. So God, whoever you are, cosmic force, thank you very much for, you know, what you've done in the past, but we'll take it from here. And you can take your book with you because your book is racist, sexist, homophobic, all these things you're hearing now on the TV, right? In Canada, the Bible's been classified as hate speech. Hate speech. We have a ministry we work with in Washington. They made us take the Ten Commandments down from the front of the building because people were offended. Because after all, you know, you shouldn't kill, you shouldn't commit adultery, of course these are politicians. You know, shouldn't steal, they were offended. Yeah, so now they're back. But the funny thing is, if you stand there in our ministry center and watch people walk by, they kind of look at the tablets going... Because for a lot of people, it's the first they've heard of it. Couldn't tell you one commandment, let alone 10. So they're going to have trouble and distress. So God tells Moses to write a song. He doesn't say, take your guitar, go to your room, and, you know, compose a song for me. And then, you know, after you write it, let's have a listen to it, and I'll tell you if I like it or not. No, he inspires Moses to write the song. It's divinely inspired. And you're going to teach it to all the people, and they're going to remember it. Next week we're going to do the lyrics. It's pretty long. We're not going to do it tonight. But the people are going to remember it, even though it's really long. And it's going to be a witness, it's going to be a reminder, and it's going to convict them that they've gone astray with their idolatry. I have a migraine, so I'm having trouble talking. But it's going to impact these people, and it's going to be a witness against them, and it's going to remain as a testimony. You're going to write down the song, I tell you. You're going to teach it to the people, and then we're all going to sing it. So get your harps. It's going to be all minor chords. Get your guitar. They're going to have a contemporary worship service at this point. It's a little joke. Come on. No organs, just, you know, harps and stuff. So the song might prevent further rebellion, further apostasy, once everybody gets together and sings it. It might bring repentance when you realize what you've done compared to what you're singing in the song. And in music, you know, you're all exposed to music, no matter what church you go to. I mean, how many times do you hear some lyrics or a few lines and you get convicted of something? That's one of the ways God communicates with us. We're going to be singing when we're in heaven. Even I'm going to be singing. Yeah. Therefore, Moses wrote this song the same day. Wrote it the same day. He's obedient. The song is inspired by God. He writes it all in the same day, and he taught it to the children of Israel. Then he inaugurated Joshua, the son of Nun. No, his mother wasn't a nun. Come on, that's a joke. Lighten up. And said, be strong and of good courage. For you shall bring the children of Israel into the land which I swore to them, and I will be with you. Therefore, Moses wrote the song the same day and taught it to the children of Israel. So Moses immediately obeys. He's the servant of God. And then he encourages Joshua. You know, this isn't going to be an easy job you're going to have. I've put up with a lot from these people. They're a stiff-necked people. They're prickly. as we like to call Israelis. They're prickly. They're very prickly. They're not polite, pleasant, and cutesy. They're prickly. They tell you exactly what they think, and they don't care if they're being rude. There are stiff-necked people. And Joshua's going to have to face rebellions. So Moses keeps telling him, he tells him four times, be of good courage. You're going to have to face things. You're going to be leading this mass of people across the river and then into the land. It's not going to be as easy as you think. So it was when Moses had completing writing the words of this law in a book, when they were finished, that Moses commanded the Levites who bore the ark of the Lord, saying, take this book of the law and put it beside the ark of the covenant of the Lord your God, that it might be there as a witness against you. So they're going to learn a song. They're going to have a book with the law. Inside the ark is going to be the tablets of the Ten Commandments. The rest of the law is going to be in a book. And this is going to be a witness against you. For I know your rebellion and your stiff neck. If today, while I am yet alive, this is Moses talking, if today, while I am yet alive with you, you have been rebellious against the Lord, then how much more after my death? You've done all this stuff with me here. Imagine when I leave. And Jesus himself says things like this. Well, when I'm gone, things are going to happen. You're going to be persecuted. You're going to be taken where you don't want to go. People are going to kill you. Your parents are going to turn you into the government, thinking that they're doing something good. People like Saul of Tarsus are going to kill you because they think they're serving God. Paul and John said, you know, when once we leave, false teachers are going to come in. It's not going to take long. It never takes long. Gather to me all the elders of your tribes and your officers that I might speak these words in their hearing and call heaven and earth to witness against them. Remember, two or three witnesses. Heaven and earth are going to witness against them. For I know that after my death you will become utterly corrupt and turn aside from the way which I have commanded you. And evil will befall you in the latter days, because you will do evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger through the works of your hands. So you've been bad, stiff-necked. Well, when I'm gone, it's going to be even worse. So the book beside the ark is going to witness against you. When they came back from Babylon, they found the book. The book was missing. The ark was never seen again. But the book of the law was found. And they started reading through it and realized that there were things they hadn't been doing in the exile. They hadn't been celebrating all the feast days. They forgot about the Feast of Tabernacles. They didn't celebrate the Sukkot. And they said, and Ezra the prophet says, oh, by the way, it's Sukkot now. Let's go celebrate it. So everybody went and built the circus and had feasts and ate great food. You can read that in the book of Nehemiah. So after Babylon, they found the book, and it served as a witness against them. But it also inspired them, because now they were back in the land. There was no more idolatry after the Babylonian exile. Of course, then they get exiled for something, worse, which was rejecting the Messiah. But the book served as a witness that they had to get back to following the covenant. The kings of Judah had taken them astray. The exile had taken them astray. Now they were back in the land. So next week we're going to do the actual song, because it has very powerful lyrics. I don't think we have the music to it though, Steve. But it's all minor chords. And I promise you we're not going to sing it. So, that's part one of the Song of Moses.